From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as the federal corruption probe focuses on UAW President Gary Jones, some in the union are reportedly questioning his future.
I'm told it didn't necessarily come down to a threat, but it was certainly a question that was raised, and it was raised in front of the executive board.
Critics ask, where's the development the Ilitch family promised for their Little Caesars Arena?
Residential and then office and mixed-use space, a hotel was promised, none of which have seen the light of day.
In this new era of legal cannabis, a doctor's warning.
Be careful, be mindful, hold off, and wait until we really understand how this chemical is acting on our brains.
And one of the last living Tuskegee Airmen, Black Flyers, who faced bigotry in World War II.
The conductor pointed to me and he said, you go up to the Jim Crow car in the front.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Bargainers for GM and the UAW are still negotiating as 46,000 GM factory workers continue their strike into a fourth day. But as Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes reports in a front page story, it looks like there is a mutiny brewing against UAW President Gary Jones. So, Daniel, what happened at last Friday's meeting of the union's International Executive Board?
Well, first off, Gary Jones survived. There was an attempt, at least by a faction, to potentially get him to step aside, as we understand it. The heads of the two other bargaining units from Ford and Fiat Chrysler raised the question about whether or not their bargaining committees would actually bargain if he remained president. Now, I'm told it didn't necessarily come down to a threat, but it was certainly a question that was raised, and it was raised in front of the executive board, as we understand it. You know, I think this really speaks to where this union is right now. The president has been implicated in a federal criminal investigation. As this strike moves into its fourth day, we've heard not a word from him. There have been letters that have been written to exhort the membership on to stay tough. One's come from the vice president of the General Motors Department, who heads the General Motors Department. Another from a regional director, Chuck Browning. But nothing from Gary Jones. And I think that signifies that the union itself as an institution has probably recognized that he's compromised.
Can you think of any point in the history of this union during a national strike when, as you said, it was confirmed by four sources with knowledge of what happened, that people were actually openly talking about should he be around?
And it's interesting, the disconnect, I think, in my view, from those of us that cover this and understand it with a little greater depth, and the national media as it's covering a strike. They don't pay a lot of attention to Detroit or General Motors or the auto industry until something blows up. And interestingly enough, a lot of people are very focused on the strike and the usual kind of stories from the picket line and what's going to happen and this, that, and the other thing. And I'm totally walking by this federal investigation into union leadership and union corruption that started very focused on the Fiat Chrysler Training Center, monies that were provided by the corporations into these training centers. It's now morphed into a misuse, what appears to be a misuse of member dues for partying and conferences and extended conferences.
For those who haven't actually followed that, and your story today digs into what the federal filings tell us, and there were the recent federal raids involving Official A and Official B, and you've confirmed, the Detroit News has confirmed the identities of those individuals?
Right. Back up just a hair. In August, there were raids in, I believe, four states, the home of President Gary Jones in Canton Township, the home of former President Dennis Williams in California, I think another place in Wisconsin and Missouri. Coincident to that, and not long thereafter, there was an indictment of the Region 5 director, which spelled out how a lot of the scheme worked and how they would go out to Palm Springs and they would have a master account, for example, just one number on it. But they'd be renting villas for union leaders who didn't spend 3 or 4 days at the conference. They camped at the conference and they stayed for a month or even more, buying $60,000 worth of cigars, Cristal champagne, going into pro shops and buying Titleist golf clubs. In one case, I cited in a column today, you know, that two Titleist hybrid clubs were the equivalent to strike pay for two striking members for a week.
$500.
$500. And it was just one example. But this is all going on. And Gary Jones, we identified through sources as being Union Official A and Dennis Williams as Union Official B. So I think a lot of people have now looked at him and said, this is a real problem. People at the top of the union, I think, are raising a lot of questions. One of the key questions now is, Does he even stay through the strike? He probably will, I would think, unless the strike gets really long, which I doubt that it would. But we don't really know what's next. The feds have, in each of the last 6 weeks, have handed down some kind of public paper, some kind of criminal charge, indictment, various other things. And we're now, it's Thursday. So the question is, do we get through this week without one? So this would be the first week in out of 7 weeks that we don't see something coming from the prosecutor's office.
Well, in the meantime, you've got to just ask yourself the impact on the rank and file as they march on those picket lines and they're hearing these stories.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, who do they believe? If Gary Jones comes out and they have a tentative agreement with General Motors and he says, this is a great deal, you know, we've seen that movie before, and in 2015 with Fiat Chrysler, it wasn't a strike, but it was a tentative agreement that was rejected. And I think the ratification risk is very high here, which puts pressure not on the union, and it puts pressure on the company. Because the company wants to cut a deal that they think they can get ratified, and that the union assures them we can get it ratified with our membership. And I think that's one of the real open questions.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
You bet.
Years ago this month, Little Caesars Arena opened up. The shiny new home for the Detroit Red Wings and later the Detroit Pistons was built with the help of Detroit taxpayers, $324 million worth of help. In return, the Ilitch family and Olympia Entertainment promised jobs for Detroiters and a lot of development for the area around LCA, the so-called District Detroit. Well, tonight brings the final public meeting of the Neighborhood Advisory Committee. They're the ones trying to hold the Ilitches and Olympia to the promises they made about District Detroit. With us is the chair of the NAC, Francis Gruno. So how does the reality, Francis, of what has been built so far compare with the promises the Ilitches made for the area around LCA?
When the pitch first happened, we were promised a mixed-use, authentic set of neighborhoods that each had names with apartments and ground floor retail and really an active urban environment. That was what was presented in pictures and images and plans. The reality is that the arena has been built. There are some ground floor uses on that footprint, but a lot of the adjacent promised projects haven't come to pass. New construction in the form of a hotel and some residences, mixed use and office buildings have either been started or never started and are sitting as vacant lots. And then a number of older buildings, historically significant buildings that were part of a package of about 700 residential units, including affordable units, have not been started in large part. Some have had work, like the Eddystone Hotel, a significant 1920s building, which the city actually has a deal, a contract with the Ilitches to complete, that is underway, and we're hopeful that that can get completed, even though it's over a year past due. So really, we are missing out on everything else but the arena, and that's unfortunate.
And you can easily find the renderings that were out there when
right.
The project was first announced and they were looking for the public financing, which they did get. So as you say, instead of residential units and shops and restaurants and offices, there are a lot of parking lots surrounding the arena. And by the way, all the revenue goes to Olympia.
Right.
So the Neighborhood Advisory Committee, it's your last public meeting. And then what's ahead and what leverage do you have to get any of this development that was promised to happen?
Sure. Well, as our name suggests, we are an advisory body or the Neighborhood Advisory Committee. So we really don't have any legal leverage over the project, unfortunately. And in other places, in other cities, there are arrangements through community benefits agreements where a local impacted neighborhood can have some leverage, but we don't have that leverage. We have provided advice and feedback at times. In the last couple of years, we've become more advocates based on some of these missed deadlines and broken promises. The city does have some leverage over the Eddystone Hotel, as well as in terms of enforcing blight, its blight ordinance. A number of properties in the District Detroit are blighted, vacant, and many are owned by the Ilitches. About 60% of properties in the area are owned by the Ilitches, and a number of them aren't compliant with the blight ordinance. So that would be, you know, putting in windows, making sure they're boarded and secured. making roof repairs, some of which haven't been done in many years. So the city can enforce current codes. The city can also, you know, hold them to account over the single significant structure that they've promised to fix up. However, a lot of the other promises that were in the news and the vision and images, and as you said, you know, that was what was sold, there really isn't a lot that can be done other than, you know, keeping it front of mind and in discussion when we think about what it means to have District Detroit and what the future of District Detroit should look like. Should it be a bunch of surface parking and parking decks and vacant buildings, or should it be something that we can reasonably expect should be in development, active development with so much public investment?
So, Francis, tell us about tonight's meeting. What time, where, and what do you expect to happen?
Sure. Our final public meeting is at the University of Michigan Detroit Center at Woodward and Mack on the northwest corner. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. It's free and open to the public. We'd love for anybody who's interested in coming. Some public officials will be there. Our council member, Raquel Castaneda Lopez, who helped champion the NAC, will be there on hand. And we'll go over the deal and the timeline. We'll just sort of do a recount of what happened. It's a very complex project. A lot of people are interested in learning, you know, what was involved. And we'll also have, as much as we can, a list of the things that the Illiches can be held accountable for and what they have agreed to. So we'll discuss that as well as the future and what people might look to in the future in terms of projects and ideas for that area. And, you know, keeping it front of mind as we go forward.
Francis Gruno, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And we always love to hear from you. What stories or people are you focused on, or issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, or send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up, in this new era of legal marijuana, a doctor's warning.
We're just in our adolescence of studying this, and the data is mixed.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
This superb One Direction highway is engineered for easy grades and for speed with safety. The echoes of that two-cylinder motor have never died, and they never will.
Call the turn signal! Use it! Learn to drive!
Traffic deaths in Michigan are up this year, up 2%. So it seems like a good time to get a refresher course on some of Michigan's forgotten or ignored rules of the road. And for that, we turn to Lieutenant Michael Shaw of the Michigan State Police. Welcome back to Stateside, Lieutenant.
Thank you for having me.
Distracted driving has become one of the buzz phrases of the 21st century, certainly one of the leading causes of auto crashes in Michigan. How is distracted driving defined by law?
So there is no definition. Hmm. And I think that's where some people say, well, can't you get them for the distracted driving law, whether there isn't a distracted driving law. So there's some different portions of it. So Michigan has a texting while driving law. You're not allowed to use an electronic device to actually plug in information to while the vehicle is moving. Usually I don't tell people this, but we're going to talk exactly what the law says. So if you're stopped at a traffic light, if you're stopped at a stop sign, if you're in traffic and you're stopped and the vehicle's not moving, technically the way the law is written, you can actually use your cell phone. Tying that into rear-ending crashes, those kind of go together because usually what somebody will be doing is looking down kind of out of the corner of their eye, see traffic start to move. They'll hit the gas, and then the car in front of them stops, and then boom, you have a rear-end crash. So we recommend to everybody not to use your phone at all. And that's our recommendation. Now, there's some different portions of that that we can tie into different laws. So if we look at careless driving, that's usually a lot of things that the people will get a ticket for from troopers is we'll combine that. So if you're on the phone, you get in a crash, that's careless driving. If you're on the phone and you commit another track offense, run through a red light, weave in your traffic lane, stop on a green and go on a red, all those things that kind of combine, that's more going to be a careless driving. Now, there is some, you know, hands-free legislation that are in the legislature that we support naturally to get that phone out of people's hands. But if you kind of think about it for a second, even if you're doing something else besides driving, it requires a part of your brain. So even if you have hands-free on and you're talking to whoever it is hands-free, we've all been there before where you thought you were on one point of the road and then you realize, holy cow, I'm 3 miles ahead of where I was.
Or you thought you were doing one speed and you kind of lost track and ended
up speeding. Yeah. So it all kind of affects it. So we use the term, get your head out of your app. And I said, yes, your app, not the other one.
Yes.
Don't use your phone at all. Just throw it to the side. There's nothing that you really need that for while you're traveling. Use the do not disturb on there. Mm-hmm. And then people will say, but I need my GPS.
Yep.
So most GPSs now are right into your car. You don't even need to use your phone for that anymore. If you do, before you start out, you know where you're going. It's not like you're driving down the roadway and all of a sudden decide, oh, I need to do this. So you plug in your GPS before you start going. Mm-hmm. And then all you do is hook it up onto that little thing that you can slide your cell phone in, and it will talk to you and tell you when to turn left and when to turn right. You don't have to touch it. You don't have to look at it. You don't have to do anything. You just have to follow the direction, kind of listening to a backseat driver.
Okay, so but it is okay to have that little gizmo. In fact, I just got one, so it's there. Yeah.
And we talked to our young troopers about this. It's not just a public issue. It's everybody. So, we talk quite a bit about our troopers that, we've had some rear-end crashes because these younger guys and gals that have grown up with their cell phones will be doing the same darn thing, that we're telling people that's not a good idea to do. And then you go out there and investigate a patrol car crash and you find out they were doing that or they're looking at their computers. So this affects everybody. It's not just a public perception problem. Everybody really needs to kind of buckle down a little bit. And I know we all use our phones, me being the media person, I'm on my phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But when I drive, I try to turn it off. And because all you're doing is teaching your kids the same thing, because kids are like a sponge. If you don't wear your seatbelt, your kids won't wear it. If you're on the phone texting all the time, your kids are too. So, you got to get rid of that phone. If it even takes throwing it in the trunk and turning it off, put it in a glove box, turn it off, use the do not disturb, get your head out of your app.
Are there differences in local ordinances and state laws?
Yes. So that's the state law. So now different cities have their own local ordinances that said that you can't use a cell phone at all.
I remember Troy got very tough. Yeah, not even coffee cups, right?
Right.
Eating?
Yeah.
Nope.
So they kind of crack down on all that kind of stuff. So you got to kind of know what cities you're driving through or where you're living, what their ordinances are. But most of them will have it marked by a sign. But the best way to avoid it is just not use it anywhere in the state. And then you don't have to worry about what city has a tougher local ordinance than the state law.
You troopers have seen the results of what can happen because of distracted driving firsthand. So what do you want people who think they can pull off texting or that quick text or putting on some mascara while they're driving? What do you want them to understand?
That it's just not worth it. That, as you go along, if you're running late, then you're late. If somebody texts you, then get back to them when you're at your spot. If you didn't have time to put your makeup on, the next day, wake up earlier than the day before. It's all personal accountability. And it's something that we've kind of gotten rid of in society where we're not accountable for our own personal things. It's always somebody else's fault. But if you got a phone in your hand and you're texting and you kill somebody, that's your fault. And it's even worse for us if we have to go to somebody's house and tell them their family member's never coming back because somebody got a text about what to get at the grocery store. That's when you really kind of start to put it into perspective. And that's what we try to teach our younger troopers. That's what we're trying to teach our younger drivers as we go through here, because this is not going away. I mean, cell phones are here to stay. Pretty soon they'll probably be embedded in our forehead before we know it. But this is something that, you know, is killing people daily. It's as bad as driving under the influence of alcohol, driving under the influence of marijuana, prescription drugs, and distracted driving. They're all the same thing. All 100% preventable. And those people that were killed by that type of driving would all be here today if somebody would have just made that decision not to do one of those things.
Lieutenant Mike Shaw, Michigan State Police, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We began our Learn to Drive segment just a couple of weeks ago, and we have been blown away by the response, gotten dozens of emails from people who want to hear something on our roadways sorted out on air with Lieutenant Shaw. Here are a couple of the emails that we got from you.
Slow down. People are too concerned with either getting to their destination quickly or they just have an infantile need for speed.
Too often in the U.S. I see maneuver or sometimes just maneuver signal, but rarely all three in the correct order.
Why have people forgotten how to use blinkers? Changing lanes? Blinker. Turning ahead? Blinker. Turning here? Blinker.
Seemingly, no one teaches Michiganders how to handle a four-way stop. They seem to look for some sense of fairness that I can't fathom.
That last one about the four-way stop, about half of you who responded to our Learn to Drive segment say you are so frustrated with four-way stop etiquette, and we heard you. We'll talk with Lieutenant Shaw about that soon. In the meantime, which rules of the road do you wish other drivers would know about? Let us know. Send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. On November 1st, businesses will be able to start applying for licenses to sell recreational marijuana. As the date comes closer, some doctors are suggesting caution based on what they've seen in other states where pot has been legalized. Dr. Christopher Blazes is a psychiatrist and an emergency medicine physician at the University of Michigan. He's also an addiction psychiatrist, so he's board certified in all three specialties, which makes you, Dr. Blazes, very uniquely qualified to talk about what emergency rooms are seeing and the psychiatric effects of cannabis. How does using recreational cannabis land people in the ER?
Well, there's so many different pathways that it works. You know, people who are very skilled at using recreational cannabis will oftentimes end up in the ER much less than those who are initiating it for the first time.
So what happens, let's say baby boomers who indulged back in college and then didn't want to give it a try, what are they going to find in 2019?
Well, the cannabis of the 60s, 70s, and 80s is very different than the cannabis of today. The percentage of the THC content, which is the most psychoactive component of cannabis,
it's the stuff that gets you high.
Exactly. It's so much different. Back then, it was maybe 3 to 5%. And now, the genetic engineering of the plants themselves, it's probably around 15 to 20%. But what's also even scarier is that more people are moving towards even higher content types of cannabis use in the edibles and the dabbing and whatnot. So those percentages can be 80 to 90% THC content. These are not subtle effects. And, you know, things that were present in nature, one could argue that nature has a lot more wisdom than we do as humans, kind of arrive at a steady state of kind of a useful amount of the substance. But when we get involved and in our modern Western culture where more is better, it's no surprise that we end up with some difficulties.
What have we seen, Dr. Blazes, in states, let's say Colorado, where cannabis has been legal for enough years to build a database and statistics that we can learn from in terms of calls to poison control centers and visits to emergency departments?
Well, we're just in our adolescence of studying this, and the data is mixed. But there was a recent study that came out that showed that the emergency department visits for cannabis use have tripled since the legalization. And this doesn't even include the visits that happen as a result of complications from cannabis, but we don't know that the people were using cannabis. So I suspect it's actually even higher than that.
So help us understand. Let's start with the kind of physical problems that can result from using this more powerful cannabis.
Well, I think the two most prominent things that happen is immediately after use, there's a significant elevation in the heart rate. And this can, in people who have underlying cardiac disease, this can lead to arrhythmias and more severe problems. There's an increased incidence of heart attacks and strokes. And so this is most worrisome in kind of the older population in the country. So you combine that with the fact that it's such a more powerful chemical that it predisposes people to psychiatric complications.
Yeah, let's launch into that then. What kind of psychiatric issues?
If people have underlying psychiatric issues, I think few people would argue against the fact that high-potency cannabis will most likely make them worse. Now, there are some exceptions to these rules, and there's a lot to be determined here. But in general, for the most part, if people have a psychotic disorder, cannabis will make it worse. And furthermore, people who do not have a psychotic disorder, it can still present with episodes of psychosis.
And we saw some recent headlines warning about teenagers, especially at risk. Is that because their brains are still developing? I mean, the frontal lobe isn't really developed until someone's in their mid-20s, right?
Exactly. And this is what's really scary, is that there's getting mixed messages, parents and teenagers, that this is safe, that this is an appropriate medical drug to be used.
Medical drug. And now it's legal recreationally.
And now it's legal
for
recreationally.
21 and up, yeah.
But, you know, the more that we learn about this from the literature and what's being researched, is it absolutely has long-standing effects. And the more we learn, the scarier it gets.
What kind of effects?
Well, I think the most recent data is interesting about, they talk about this idea of pruning. The brain, as it fully develops, initially it has more synapses than we actually need to use. And then during the late adolescent period, the brain actually prunes them down to fine-tune and make them kind of the most efficient neural pathways. There's evidence now that the cannabis actually disrupts that pruning process. So that, in conjunction with the myelination that doesn't happen, as you alluded to, until you're 25 or 26 years old, we're learning that the cannabis directly disrupts these processes.
And what's the result then? What could be the difference in someone who, you know, has been using cannabis since their teens who did not? What would you see long range?
Well, again, there's so many different aspects, but we definitely know for a fact that there's an amotivational syndrome.
I mean,
we all joke about the fact that people who use a lot of cannabis end up on their parents' couches forever. But there's actually medical evidence to show that. There's evidence to show that it decreases your IQ, that there's cognitive deficits over time. You know, in addition to the fact that it increases the likelihood that if you have a propensity towards psychosis or psychiatric disorders, that this can unmask. And this brings into the account the idea of these epigenetic phenomenons, which is fascinating. And epigenetics is the idea that just we have these parts of our genes which normally are too tight and they can't be expressed. But if we get exposed to a certain type of stimulus, like a drug or an experience, it unravels these histones and then they can be expressed. Mm. So perhaps someone who had not been exposed to cannabis and would never become psychotic ever, but if they were, if these histones unravel, they can become psychotic. And
we're really in unknown territory, aren't we? Because federal restrictions have been so tight, there aren't any real good guidelines for safe use of marijuana and cannabis.
It's frustrating as a physician because the term medical marijuana is used, but in most other instances, when we use the term medical, then it's something that we can prescribe. We know what dose to use. We have regulations on what is actually being taken in by the patient. And furthermore, we have studies to know how they will be affected as a result of taking these medications. And we have so little of that data for cannabis in the modern era.
So we don't know about cannabis, THC, or CBD as far as how much is too much. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. We really don't. And I'm just glad you also brought up the idea of CBD, because a lot of people kind of lump them together, THC and CBD, but they are vastly different chemicals. You know, and in my opinion as an addiction psychiatrist, I actually believe that down the road there will be more uses for CBD than THC, because they actually oppose each other in some ways. In some sense, the CBD is almost like the body's natural kind of breaks mechanism, so that in normal kind of marijuana plants, it produces both THC and CBD. The THC has the psychoactive components, and the CBD kind of like tempers the effects of the THC. But yet again, we're still in our early phases of understanding of this, and there aren't enough studies out. But I think first and foremost is recognizing that they are two vastly different chemicals that need to be studied separately is important.
Do you have concerns that CBD is making its way into so many consumer products, including food and drink?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, how can we, as a government who has the responsibility to maintain safety through, you know, Food and Drug Administration regulations, allow the insertion of a chemical that we don't even really understand how it works yet? I mean, it's showing up everywhere.
A Washington Post story on all of this says the cannabis industry disagrees that its products pose a danger. They say more studies are needed and existing data, and I'll quote here, are inconclusive about whether changes that have been linked to early cannabis use are damaging in the long term.
And of course they're inconclusive because studying these chemicals is so hard and there's so many limitations in studying them. You know, for example, to do a randomized controlled trial or any type of serious type of investigation in literature, you have to go through so many regulations in order to just get the approval to go through the study. And this is because cannabis at this point is still Schedule I drug. And to do studies on Schedule I drugs is incredibly complicated. And so it's hard to arrive with good data in this setting.
Here we are with this disconnect between the federal view of cannabis and Michigan's view and other states. So what's the next thing? You're putting this out here now. Now what? What do you want to see happen?
Well, I think that it's time to pause for a moment and bringing in some of the, you know, the aspects of mindfulness and recognize that this is an exciting idea and we're living in a complex, overstimulating world. And it's a natural inclination to want to have something to help us tolerate this world. And we're looking for something that's safe and effective. And so we have certain governmental bodies that are saying, like a lot of the state governments, this is safe and effective for so many different things, but the data really isn't there to support that. So I think we need to take a pause and step back and say, wait, I'm not going to use myself as a guinea pig and end up being one of those complications that happens. I think I want to wait until I see what happens.
Are you bottom line warning people back off and don't plunge into recreational marijuana use?
Well, I am a biased individual. I will say that by the fact that I'm an addiction psychiatrist, and perhaps I see the most complicated cases of that. But, you know, in terms of what I would recommend to my family members is absolutely. I would be careful, be mindful, hold off, and wait until we really understand how this chemical is acting on our brains.
Dr. Christopher Blazes, he is a psychiatrist, an emergency medicine physician, and a board-certified addiction psychiatrist at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
After the break, we'll hear from one of the last living Tuskegee airmen.
But I used to go over as a teenager and sit near the airport and just watch the planes fly and fantasize that I was up there with them in the cockpit flying the plane along.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are now only 11 of the legendary Tuskegee Airmen still alive, men who flew combat missions in World War II. And retired Lieutenant Colonel Harry T. Stewart, Jr. is one of those last men standing. The Bloomfield Hills man turned 95 this summer. His life is the subject of a book published this summer, co-authored by aviation writer Philip Handelman. It's called Soaring to Glory, a Tuskegee Airman's firsthand account of World War II. I spoke with Colonel Stewart earlier this year to talk about his life and his service. Colonel Stewart, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
It's a pleasure being here.
So you flew 43 combat missions, awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, a Congressional Gold Medal for your valor with the 332nd Fighter Group, the Red Tails. Going back earlier, what are your first memories of seeing aircraft and being called to fly them?
Well, my parents told me. I was born in Newport News, Virginia. And we lived not too far from a Army airfield in Newport News by the name of Langley Field. My parents used to put me out in the crib in the daytime to sun me, and they told me that when the planes would fly over, I would look up and Google at the planes and coo along, that type of thing. And like I wanted to be up there with the pilots. And around 2 years old, my parents, we all moved the family to Queens in New York, about a mile and a half from an airport by the name of North Beach Airport. That today is now LaGuardia Airport. But I used to go over as a teenager and sit near the airport and just watch the planes fly and fantasize that I was up there with them in the cockpit flying the plane along. So I think that was my initiation, or those were my initiations in wanting to become a pilot.
And of course, the chances of an African-American being able to fly were pretty limited until the door opened with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and then earlier that year, the Army decided it would train, and I'm going to use the parlance of the day, an all-Negro flying unit. And we should remember, in World War I, the Army had refused to even consider allowing blacks to even be aerial observers. But they opened that door, and you volunteered for the Army Air Corps on your 18th birthday. But I read in the book, as a little boy, you'd had polio and a heart murmur. How'd you clear that physical?
Well, I sort of hid them from discovery by the doctors there. I know that when I went in to take my physical, as far as my leg was concerned, my right leg, which had a slight paralysis in the calf muscle, and I had no Achilles reflex. And when the doctor went to hit the Achilles tendon with his mallet there, I almost kicked the mallet out of his hand. So he assumed that everything must have been all right as far as my leg was concerned. As far as the heart was concerned, I was within a line of inductees at the time there, and they had a couple of doctors who were just walking along, listening to the hearts of the future soldiers that stood there. And the one that came to my heart, he listened, and he took some time to listen again, and then he called the other doctor over, and he said, "Say, listen to this." And the other doctor came over and listened, and he said, "It's all right." And that was it.
So you pass the physical, you leave Queens for basic training in Biloxi, Mississippi, and then flight training in Tuskegee, Alabama. And as we see in this book, Soaring to Glory, what a change for a man of color who'd grown up in Queens. Tell us about those first times when you came up against Jim Crow. What happened, and how did you choose to react?
Well, the first time was when I got on the Penn Station, New York, to go down to, pardon me, Biloxi, Mississippi. And when we got to Washington, the conductor came into the car that I was in, and I happened to be with some kids from my neighborhood at the time. They were white, and the conductor pointed to me, and he said, "You go up to the Jim Crow car in the front." So my parents had warned me about this and told me that there was institutional segregation in the South, and that when I passed the Mason-Dixon line that runs through Washington there, that I would be relegated to question of integration and segregation, I should say. But anyway, the fellas that were with me, they said, "Well, Harry, we'll go up front with you." And the conductor says, "No, no, you don't." He said, "That's the car for the Negro people." And I didn't make an argument. I just went up front. But I think in incidents like that and further incidents that were to come along, I just kept my eye on the prize, and the prize being getting my wings as a Air Corps pilot, and that was about it.
You stayed focused, and it was very stunning to read about there was your first flight in an open cockpit. You were in that PT-19 trainer, and flying over Alabama fields where your grandfather had been born into slavery.
Yes, he was born in 1863, and it was quite a sensation to be flying up over near Montgomery, Alabama, where he was born, and that was my first solo and my first introduction to flight. I had never been up in a aircraft before, and it was quite an experience.
The book makes it very, very clear, Colonel Stewart. Training was tough. Your class started with 75 cadets. Only 26 made it to the end. But on June 27th, 1944, you were commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army Air Forces. You were 19 years old, and you didn't even have a driver's license.
Being from New York, you know, you really didn't need a car. The family didn't have a car, so I didn't know how to drive.
But you were a flyer, and they sent you to Italy to be deployed with the now legendary 332nd Fighter Group, the Red Tails. Colonel Stewart, if you would you just listen for a moment? And I want you to tell me if this tune rings a bell for you.
All right.
Why you here? making fun of the ones who love you. Breaking.
Do you recognize that song?
I do. You're bringing tears to my eyes. And anyway, Little Coquette. And that was Guy Lombardo, I believe.
It was.
Was playing that rendition of it. There was one other orchestra played a rendition of it also. It was Duke Ellington.
Yes.
But
why is that song special to you?
I just loved it. That's all. I loved the tune. And I don't know. There was something about the tune that I liked. I didn't have a girlfriend at the time. So when it came to putting the nose art on my aircraft there, I decided to go ahead and have them put Little Coquette as the nose art, and that was it. That's what I had on my aircraft.
Your brand new P-51D Mustang. And if you've just joined us, I am speaking with one of the last surviving members of the legendary Tuskegee Airmen, Lieutenant Colonel Harry Stewart, Jr. Aviation writer Philip Handelman's latest book, Soaring to Glory, tells us the story of Colonel Stewart's life. You know, sir, I've known a number of B-17 flyboys through my time volunteering for Honor Flight. Some were POWs, and to a man, they said, if you found yourself on the ground in German territory, you wanted to find German soldiers because civilians were much more dangerous to a downed American flyer. And you lost a friend that way, didn't you?
Yes, we did. It was April 1st of 1945. Incidentally, that happened to be Easter Sunday and also April Fool's Day, but we had just completed escorting bombers up into Austria, and the bombers were started heading back home, and a contingent of the escort that I was in there, a contingent of seven planes, were ordered to perform a fighter sweep in the area. This was around the Danube and Linz, Austria, Wels, Austria, and not too far from Vienna. But anyway, fighter sweep was to destroy any rolling stock that we saw on the ground, river, barges, and enemy aircraft, if possible. And this was all to make it more difficult as far as, or bring the war to a speedy conclusion. Anyway, to make a long story short, we were attacked by a large group of German aircraft. They were fighter planes, FW-190Ds. Three of the seven of us, got shot down. One managed to take his crippled plane to friendly territory in Yugoslavia. The second, he was instantly killed when he was shot down. The third, his name was Walter Manning. He was from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He was able to bail out of his aircraft, but as soon as he alighted in his parachute, he was captured by a mob and delivered to the local jailhouse in Linz, Austria there. About 2 nights later, in fact, exactly 2 nights later, another mob formed and broke into the jail. Took Walter Manning out of the jail, beat him up pretty severely, but then they lynched him from a lamppost in the street. And it wasn't that he was the only one that that had happened to.
Yeah.
But as you said, and as you introduced that story there, is that it was a dangerous thing for anybody to bail out or near the area where not only the bombing had occurred, but also where the civilian populace had control there. It would be better to be captured by one of the military personnel.
And I know it was also on that day you flew the mission that earned you the Distinguished Flying Cross. You downed three German fighter planes in that one mission. You were honorably discharged from active duty in 1950. You were 25. You had hundreds of flight hours. You're a decorated war hero. You know, you had helped to defeat the Nazis, and you wanted to be a commercial pilot. Can you briefly tell us what happened when you presented yourself to Pan Am and TWA?
Yes, I was just summarily dismissed as a as not being qualified by virtue of the fact that I was African-American. One of the companies, they said outright that they just weren't accepting black individuals as air crew members, which was not true because I had just read, I think the day before, a small advertisement in the paper that they were looking for pilots to train. The other company, I think it was the vice president of personnel, came out and tried to rationalize why they would not accept me, and he used the reasoning or the rationale that the passengers would be extremely upset to see a black man walking down the aisle and getting into the cockpit and taking the plane off. That feeling and situation prevailed, you know, for a couple of years, and then I will say that the airlines relented and they gradually started accepting African Americans as crew members, as pilots, and
but by then you'd moved on.
I had moved on then,
yeah.
But you know, bringing it up till to today, in every major airline that we have in the country, we have blacks flying in the cockpit there as pilots and co-pilots, also air crew members, your carriers or such as UPS and FedEx. They have a large contingent of black crew members. And I mentioned bringing tears to my eyes when you were playing Little Coquette, but brought tears to my eyes when I was taking a trip a couple of years ago and leaving Detroit here, the Metro Airport, going somewhere. I can't remember where, but anyway, when I entered the plane, I looked into the cockpit there, and there were two African-American pilots. One was the co-pilot, and one was the pilot. But not only that, the thing that started bringing the tears to my eyes is they were both female.
Wow. So you can assume the mantle of trailblazer. Then we also see in the book, amends were made in later years. You were made an honorary pilot by Delta and American Airlines.
That's right.
Also, it was a very, very powerful moment in the book, Soaring to Glory, March 2007. The Tuskegee Airmen were presented the Congressional Gold Medal by President George W. Bush, of course, himself the son of a war pilot, and reading about the president saluting all of you is that brought tears to my eyes. But
yes,
how did that feel to you at that moment?
Well, it was I can hardly just awesome. The president, you know, stood back and he was, you know, apologizing for the way the nation had treated its black citizens during the war there, and he says, "I even understand that, you know, even you as officers had terrible events where you were not even saluted at times by the white soldiers there." And he says, "But I want to make amends as far as that's concerned." And he stood back and drew himself up to full attention and threw up his right arm and saluted the group that was in front of him there.
Mm. You know, speaking of making amends, were you among the many, many black veterans who did not get any of the benefits promised by the GI Bill?
No, I did get all the benefits, so I did not fall in that category, but I certainly think that's, you know, horrifying that there were those men who sacrificed the way that they did, and they did not get their just reward for it.
Yes, and I know you went on to become a mechanical engineer and did very well.
Well, that's right. When I found out that I couldn't meet my dream as far as an airline pilot was concerned, I was running out of time as far as age was concerned. I decided to go to a fallback position, which, well, anyway, I went to New York University, got my degree in mechanical engineering, and went up the corporate ladder from there. And I found it very gratifying, and I eventually retired as vice president of a oil and gas consortium right in Detroit here.
Colonel Stewart, what are your thoughts and your feelings on the love and the affection and gratitude that's being shown to those of you who have been dubbed the greatest generation?
Well, it's well appreciated because it was sort of a come down at the end of the war, I think. But then a lot of those feelings were resurrected, especially with the In the case of the Tuskegee Airmen, there were two movie films that came out. One was an HBO film by the name of the Tuskegee Airmen, and the other was a George Lucas film by the name of the Red Tails.
Well, and it's probably worth mentioning that the Tuskegee Airmen National Museum is on Jefferson Avenue in Detroit, right here in Michigan, and it's certainly worth seeing. And I have to say, it is very much worth reading the book on your life, Soaring to Glory, a Tuskegee Airman's firsthand account of World War II, written by Philip Handelman, along with my guest, Lieutenant Colonel Harry T. Stewart, Jr. Sir, it has been a pleasure to talk with you and to say from the bottom of everyone's hearts, thank you for your service.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Tell me why you keep fooling little coquette, making fun of the ones who love you.